Hey, Prime members, you can listen to America Changed Forever ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
CBS presents America Changed Forever with CBS News correspondent Jeff Pegues.
This week, uncertain times for the economy. That is where we will begin this program. Should we be worried? That's the question I keep asking myself. Should we be worried? Is this going to be another serious downturn in the economy? I'm sure many of you are asking the same questions. And by the way, what should we make of this collapse of Silicon Valley Bank? Most of us hadn't heard of that bank until last week, and now SVB is almost a household name.
Larger U.S. banks have been flooded with new deposits after the sudden collapse of SVB. Bank of America reportedly received more than $15 billion. J.P. Morgan has seen billions flowing in as well.
I immediately looked at a larger bank.
Anthony Coombs, who founded a mail-order underwear company in Santa Monica, moved most of his money out of SVB to a bank he says is too big to fail.
The first thing I did, and I'd never done this before, is I went online and saw total amount of assets each bank held. Because really, the end goal here is, do we think this bank will go under?
While in Washington, lawmakers want SVB's executives to be held accountable.
Well, they almost cratered our entire banking system. They paid themselves bonuses, even as their bank was collapsing.
Channeling that frustration, Senator Blumenthal and other Democrats have introduced legislation aimed at failing banks. If passed, it would claw back any bonuses and profits earned from stock sales within 60 days of a financial firm's collapse.
That was Errol Barnett reporting, a CBS News correspondent. I wanted to get more perspective on that bank collapse. Joining us now is Morris Pearl. He spent many years as an investment banker, and he was tapped by the Federal Reserve and Treasury Department as part of a team at BlackRock to structure and assess the cost of the Citibank bailout during the 2008 financial crisis. Morris, thanks for being with us.
Great to be in your show, Jeff.
All right. This is a really unique moment in some ways. The way this has all unfolded, beginning with SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, and its collapse. The reason why I wanted to speak with you is because, obviously, as I've mentioned to our listeners, you have a background in situations like these, assessing the cost of bailouts. Would you characterize, or how would you characterize what the Biden administration has done thus far with SVB? Would you characterize it as a bailout?
Well, no, it's not a bailout of the bank. It's not a bailout of Silicon Valley Financial. It's a rescue of the depositors, the people that put money in the bank, not thinking that they were investing it to risk it and try to earn interest. They were putting money in the bank because they wanted to have a checking account because they needed to write checks and pay bills. So yeah, I think those people are being protected by this special arrangement, and not really the cost to the taxpayers, but the cost to the banking industry through the FDIC assessments. So no, it's not a bailout, like banks were actually bailed out, you know, in 2008, 2009. So no, they're not doing that again.
How would you judge the way the Biden administration has handled this thus far? Obviously, we're about a week into this. So how would you characterize how they've handled it?
Well, their priority is preventing runs on all the other banks and of protecting the people who work in hospitals and factories and all kinds of places whose paychecks are being sent by, you know, payroll processors or employers who deal with Silicon Valley Bank. And yeah, I would have preferred the bank not failing. I would have preferred if regulators, you know, stood up and said, oh, something's wrong, like a year ago. That would have been nice, or at least, you know, 6 months ago. But given what happened, given the bank was run by people who were frankly asleep at the switch and, you know, sort of would have failed asset liability management 101 if they had even signed up for the class, I think they did the right thing. I think they are preventing runs on other banks by saying that the FDIC is going to stand behind the depositors. There's no need to withdraw all your money and only put it in the, you know, four or six banks that we know are too big to fail. You're allowed to use the other thousands of regional and community banks all over the country and not feel that your money is insecure. So yeah, I think that the government did the right thing.
Let me ask you, can you explain for our listeners why something like this happened to a bank like Silicon Valley Bank that had so many billions under management? How does something like that happen, and happen what seems to be relatively quickly?
It wasn't that quick. It was over a period of months, although most people weren't paying attention till a few days ago. What happened was they took in billions of dollars in deposits from companies in the Santa Clara area and from around the country who wanted to deal with their bank. And then their customers didn't really want a lot of short-term loans. So what they did is they invested huge amounts of that money in what we call mortgage-backed securities, guaranteed by Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae.
You just mentioned a term there that a lot of Americans will remember from 2007, 2008, mortgage-backed securities and investing in mortgage-backed securities. In 2008, that didn't work for a lot of banks. So are we seeing the same underlying issues again?
No. In 2008, the problem was that banks gave mortgages to people who did not have enough money to make their monthly payments. In this case, people are making their monthly payments perfectly fine. They aren't even behind in their mortgages. The thing is, these mortgages are issued at very low interest rates a year or so ago. Now, people want their deposited money back, or at least some of it. And these mortgages issued at very low interest rates can't be sold when interest rates are much higher. And even though all the payments are being made on time, the people's credit ratings are perfectly good. The mortgages are fine in terms of making their payments on time and the credit, but they're much lower interest rates than current mortgages. And people are not prepaying them early. A year ago, 30% of people on an annualized basis were paying off their mortgage early. And that means a mortgage, if 30% are paid off early, is only like lasts 2 or 3 years on average. Now, that's more like 4% are paying off their mortgages early. And a mortgage only 4% of the people pay off early is more like a 20-year mortgage. And so it's very sensitive to interest rates. those mortgages that were worth 100 cents in the dollar when they issued a year or two ago are now worth 90 cents in the dollar, maybe even less. I don't know exactly what mortgages they have. So the problem is interest rates went up, so the mortgages are worth less. And people are prepaying them less, so they're lasting even longer. And those things, the bank had no way to sell the mortgages for enough money to have enough money to pay back the depositors. That was their problem. They had deposits that could be withdrawn on a day's notice, or no notice at all, actually. And they had mortgages that were last 20, 30 years. And there was a huge mismatch there. And that's exactly the kind of thing that bank managers are told they're required to manage. And these bank managers seem to have failed completely in managing that risk.
All right. So you make it sound really easy. I mean, clearly, you know what you're talking about. It's taking, you know, a little time for me to keep up with you. And I'm sure there's some of you or listeners out there who feel the same way. But the way you explain it, it seems so simple. Was it that simple? And you've kind of discussed this. Should these managers have seen the signs coming months ago?
Yes. I say yes 1,000 times. The end of year financial statements from the bank clearly showed that they'd already lost huge amounts of money on these mortgages. So they clearly knew late last year that they were losing huge amounts of money and that they did not have, that mortgages could not be sold for enough to pay off the depositors, or very nearly, they were very nearly that bad, you know, late last year. And yeah, I mean, sure, everything seems simpler in retrospect, but I honestly believe they should have thought of this case. That's exactly what bank managers are supposed to do, is think about, well, what will happen if rates go down? What will happen if rates go up? What will happen if more people prepay? What will happen if fewer people prepay? What will happen if there's a huge blizzard and we have to close the bank because of a snowstorm? They're supposed to think about all those different scenarios. That is their job. And these guys, maybe they were stupid, but I doubt it. Or maybe they just thought, we'd rather take more risk because if it pays off, which it usually does, we'll make lots of money and be great. And if it doesn't pay off, well, yeah, we'll get fired and the FDIC will have to take over the bank and this and that. So it could be they knowingly decided to take all the, to take on, you know, what now seems like too much risk.
When does taking on too much risk become criminal?
Criminal? I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to answer that question directly. But that's why we regulate banks, because bank, you know, owners, if you own a bank, you could make a lot of money if things go well. But, and so your incentive is to take a lot of risk because you get the profit when things go well and the FDIC gets the losses if things go poorly. So the FDIC puts in all kinds of regulations. It says, no, you're not supposed to take too much risk. That's not allowed. And bank managers, of course, want to go right up to the line. You know, if you look at their transcripts, they say, oh, we invested in treasury securities. And they're calling them treasuries, even though they're really, they would have said mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by an agency of the federal government. It's more like what they should have said. But they weren't, I don't know if they weren't thinking or whatever, but what they did should be, I mean, I don't know if criminal is a strong word, but should not be allowed.
Well, we know, Morris, that the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating. What? No, and you made this very clear. You're not a lawyer, you're not a prosecutor, but as someone who's worked in the banking industry, what do you think prosecutors will be looking for?
I mean, one thing I would be looking for is their 12B, their plan for having the executives selling stock. Executives are allowed to sell stock without worrying about insider trading if they announce it months in advance and say, oh, I'm going to sell 100 shares on the first Tuesday of every month, regardless of the price, starting next month. this guy sold a lot, the CEO sold a lot of stock just before this happened, according to one of these plans. But the plan was only put into effect like a week earlier. So one might think he already had material inside information at the time he started the plan. So I think that's something somebody might want to look into, is whether the the CEO and senior executives sold their stock in the bank based on material inside information that was not known to the general public. I mean, I don't know what else. I mean, they presumably would be looking at whether they made false or misleading statements to investors. But I have no idea if they did or not. I mean, they certainly disclosed a lot of information, of which some analysts were saying months ago that this bank was taking a lot of risk. So I don't really know what else prosecutors might be looking at.
That's something that seems to be relatively easier for investigators to uncover, because there should be a digital trail or paper trail somewhere.
Oh, it's nothing secret. I mean, they publicly disclosed how the person sold shares just a week or two ago. The question would be whether it's illegal or not. I mean, the SEC has a rule called 10b5-1, which means they're allowed to sell stock on a predetermined plan. And he did have a predetermined plan, but it was only predetermined like a week or two earlier. So that would be the question. It's nothing. It's not like they're hiding something, or maybe they are hiding something. But I mean, it's not like they're hiding the fact that the guy sold stock just a week or two before this all happened.
So we've been talking about SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, but there's another bank out there, which was the third biggest bank failure in U.S. history, right after SVB, and that's Signature Bank. Do you have any insight into what might have gone wrong there? Already we know the leadership of the bank was fired. Was it by the Treasury Department? Who does the firing in cases like that?
Well, what happened in that case was that the New York State superintendent of the banking, Harris, stepped in and took over the bank, and then asked the FDIC, part of the federal government, to be the receiver of the bank. Because it was actually a state banking department decided that the bank was essentially insolvent. Exactly what happened, I don't know. I haven't been following Signature Bank. But that was a New York state government decision to shut down that bank.
It was another sudden collapse of a bank. Apparently, according to some board members of that bank, there was a run on deposits. And I guess that's the panic that a lot of people talk about when things like this happen. The depositors, they try to get their money back, and so there's this run on deposits. Do you see any sort of similarities between what happened in 2007, 2008, and what's happening now?
Well, in both cases, people want to have their money in the bank and don't want to have to worry about it. And so they depend on the FDIC. And if they think that they have money that the FDIC won't cover for some reason, they get nervous sometimes. You know, if they're not confident the bank will give them their money back and they're not confident the FDIC will cover it, then it makes sense to do something else with their money. You know, maybe just ask for cash and, you know, keep it in a shopping bag under your bed. But we'd prefer them not have to do that. I mean, that's why we have an FDIC. And that's what the government is trying to do, is to give people confidence. Because if you think about it, most of your money is represented by, you know, numbers you can look at on your computer screen or your iPhone or something that represent balances in your checking account. And you have to have confidence that you can spend that money if you want to. So confidence is really the heart of the financial system. If people lose confidence in banks in general, then means we couldn't do what we now do. We couldn't pay for stuff with iPhones. We couldn't pay for stuff with credit cards. People would have to carry around, you know, purses full of gold coins like they did in the, you know, 18th century. So we'd prefer greatly not to go back to that time, and that people be able to spend money that's represented by bank deposits freely. And so the government has to give people confidence, and that's what they're trying to do.
How many decades did you spend in banking?
I spent one working for BlackRock, mostly helping to research banks, and about two in working in investment banking and structured finance, dealing with mortgages and mortgage-backed securities and things like that.
I see. So given your experience, I'm wondering how you feel about Wall Street, the big investment banks, the banks that have recently run into trouble. Do you think these kinds of banks take on more risk than they should be, than they know is legal, just to get that big bonus at the end of the year?
Well, I think that people are incentivized to take on as much risk as is legal. If the FDIC tells them it's legal to take on this much risk, they take on exactly that much risk and not one iota less. I mean, at least that's what they try to do. You know, we need to have regulations that give the regulators power to tell the bankers, no, you are essentially risking the taxpayers' money, the FDIC money, the public's money, and no, you're not allowed to do this. I think having, lengthy written regulations sometimes is tough, because lawyers with, bright colored ties and suspenders can always find some way to obey the letter of the law and violate the spirit of the law at the same time. So I think we need regulators who, have authority and who are bold and who can stand up to these guys and say, no, you're not allowed to do this. And even if you think that you're a great person and you're providing loans for wonderful companies and all that, no, you're not allowed to take these risks that we think are not prudent.
Morris Pearl, thanks for coming on the program.
Great. Thank you. Great to be on your show.
The brutal police killing of Tyre Nichols in Memphis is focusing attention on how officers are trained. An article in the Washington Post shines a spotlight on the city's police academy and how it has allegedly been cutting corners to graduate more police officers to city streets. Robert Klemko is the reporter on the story, and he joins us now. Robert, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
All right, tell us about this article that you wrote. What you are alleging is that part of the reason we're talking about the five officers involved in the Tyre Nichols case is in part because of the academy and the training that Memphis police officers are and aren't getting. Could you explain?
Yeah, that was the feeling of the nine current and former officers who had roles at the academy. Those officers that I reached out to after, sort of trying to talk to as many Memphis police officers affiliated with the academy as I could, these nine felt like once the department faced a hiring crisis beginning in around 2014, 2015, standards were lowered in ways that were not disclosed to local political leadership and largely done in secret within the academy.
What did you find? What were some of the standards that were lowered to increase the number of recruits?
So just getting into the academy, they broadened the pool by removing the college requirement, or there was a requirement to have some amount of college coursework done, and that was removed. But that was a very public thing. In order to maintain graduation rates with much larger class sizes, in order to fill this staffing void, they did things like allowing recruits to fail tests 3, 4, 5 times, test failures that would have led to dismissal in past academies. I heard of instances where students were caught cheating or even admitted to cheating, and were allowed to stay within the academy, something that all the officers I spoke to said would not have been allowed when they entered the department. There were physical fitness standards that were altered, and the instructors also said that the academy was split into two camps. Those who were okay with either fudging the numbers or giving people as many chances as they could to get through the academy, or and instructors who weren't okay with it.
Some of the instructors you talked about described a period where it became clear to them that the academy was in decline. Why do you think they felt that way?
You know, I think they felt like the quality of candidate that had once come through the academy and become an officer was changing, and that the people that they were seeing go through the academy would not have passed when they went through the academy. And I think many of them, especially the ones that I spoke to, you know, for obvious reasons, were upset about this because they feel a great deal of responsibility in leading the academy.
How have city leaders in Memphis responded to your reporting?
Well, Chief Davis and Mayor Strickland, the latter of whom oversaw this entire period that we're writing about with the academy in decline, declined our request for comment and were not made available for interview requests. We sent both the city and the police department a detailed list of our findings and got no response. So that's not really surprising. I'm not sure what they would have said to mitigate any of this or defend any of this, other than to say that they faced a staffing crisis. And, you know, the choice was between having completely depleted department or one with, you know, still not enough officers, but a manageable amount of officers. The interesting thing about all this is that even as they lowered standards for getting into the academy and getting through the academy, they still remain severely short-staffed.
Yeah, a lot of police departments across the country remain short-staffed, and there have been these concerns that police departments across the country are speeding people through the academy and lowering the requirements for the new recruits. Did you in your reporting find that the standards that have been lowered in Memphis are true of other departments across the country?
So that's very hard to say. When I spoke to experts about that question, they said they wouldn't be surprised if that were the case, but they didn't have any hard data on that question. One thing that we find when we try to write about or study the world of policing, and especially police training, is that it's very secretive. And most of the time, even a syllabus isn't available online. And any information that you get is going to be through a public records request. Obviously, that's not the case for most professional disciplines, but that is the case for policing.
Every time, and I've obviously covered a lot of these stories in the 30 years of my career, but every time I do, when you talk to veteran officers, more often than not, they will say that what happened in one of these excessive force situations is an example of a lack of training. A lot of these incidents, they say, could be prevented with better training and better screening of recruits. What's your response to that?
You know, I'm a little bit skeptical of that, because I think so much of this incident has to do with the permissions that these guys were given after graduation. They're a group of officers all within 6 years of academy graduation. That's true. But for the last year and a half, they've been on a unit that has essentially been given free rein to exercise beyond the bounds of the Constitution. And we know this because of all the different allegations that came up around the Scorpion unit after the death of Tyree Nichols. There is still no justification given for the stop. And I know for a fact that in that academy, they train you on, you know, when to effect a traffic stop. It's not like that's something that wasn't hammered into them when they were at the academy, regardless of whether the standards had been lowered. So I think that blaming one thing or another as the biggest reason, there's a little bit of folly in that. We can't really say, you know, what the biggest factor is, but I think to ignore the circumstance of this unit that these guys found themselves in and its practices and blame things on training would be a mistake.
And we confirmed last week the Department of Justice is going to be looking at the Scorpion unit and how it operated, but also similar units across the country. Do you think the department in Memphis is going to have more problems recruiting in the wake of the Tyre Nichols incident?
Yes and no. I think after these sorts of incidents, you do see a number of folks who want to join to help fix things or help repair the relationship between the city and the community. I do think that they're going to have a hard time getting experienced officers to transfer from other places, which has become a super competitive marketplace across the country. You know, you have different departments putting up ads in different states. I think there was a police department in Florida that this month took their boat up to the river that runs through Chicago to advertise. So I think that they will have trouble getting officers to transition from a less scrutinized climate to the level of scrutiny that they're going to be in. So they're going to have to rely almost entirely on fresh recruits. And, you know, if you know anything about how their academy runs, that's sort of a scary prospect.
Let's talk about some of the new recruits to the Memphis Police Department that you mentioned in your article. One of them was Jamarcus, is it James?
Jeems, I believe it's pronounced.
Jamarcus Jeems, he was in the academy. What is his story?
So he was in the academy in 2017 during the 123rd session, and that was the session that the instructors I spoke with felt marked the beginning of the decline of standards within the academy. And they felt that his case was sort of exemplary of that decline. He was able to graduate despite being accused of sexual harassment towards a female instructor and being he was accused of being inebriated on graduation day. And in between, there were a number of other complaints about him that were, you know, investigated and dropped. So he's one of these recruits that gets through the academy, and a number of instructors who had him or who taught him felt like that was unique for this generation, that a person like him would not be able to graduate the Memphis Police Academy in years past.
How has the police chief, the police department, responded?
They haven't. You know, I think that there's an effort within the department to understand who the officers I spoke to are. From some of the anonymous officers who spoke to me, one has said that he's been contacted and asked whether or not he spoke to the Washington Post. But externally, they haven't said anything about this article. I imagine the only time that they, or I guess the first time that they may be asked to answer for it, is the next time they appear before the city council in Memphis.
Robert Klemko, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Earlier this year, we discussed training issues within police departments with Chuck Wexler, who runs the Police Executive Research Forum.
You know, what has he done? It's a traffic violation. We have his car. He's running away. We know who he is. So, you know, New York has 100,000 warrants. So if they had 100,001, Tennessee has, you know, what we know where he lives. He's 100 yards away from his family's home. He runs home. And the next day we knock on the door and say, hey, you've got a traffic violation or whatever it is. You know, if you look at this from a proportionality standpoint, that's the new way of thinking. You would say, what would these officers doing? What was the danger? What was the risk? What was the sense of immediacy to get this man under control? You have his car. If that was the issue, then, you know, tow his car and let him go home and next day, you know, get a summons or whatever. I'm not even sure if this was a felony. I'm not even aware of what exactly he did. Nobody can really explain that. So has enough happened since the George Floyd murder? I would say in some places, yes, and in some places, no. But changing American policing is a Herculean effort because it's so decentralized. And you know, I was thinking about this, and what's troubling about all of this from our standpoint organizationally is there's about 600,000 or 700,000 cops in the United States. And You know, every day, let's say half of that works. And if each one of them stops, say, 5 to 8 people, so that's 1.5 million different, you know, stops or occasions to interact. And if there are 30% are wearing body cameras, the probability of having some kind of incident, not necessarily one that's as horrific as this, is pretty high. And how are we going to change that? How do you change American policing that's so decentralized? Do you think about regional academies? Do you think about, you know, some way to bring standards and training? And here's the other thing. Here's the really interesting takeaway. We are having a recruiting, hiring, and retention crisis in this country right now with cops, military and teachers too, but cops in particular. Nobody wants to be a cop. After the Tyree Nichols murder, this is only going to make it more difficult, and quite honestly, may make it more difficult to hire African Americans who may simply look at this as, you know, this is not the job for me, and that would be very bad. So that's a crisis that already was occurring in the post George Floyd period that will only be compounded by the Nichols death.
According to the experts, what is happening in Memphis is likely the case in other police academies across the country. This week, there was a hearing in McAllen, Texas, a congressional hearing, and a Border Patrol official, one of his statements caught my attention. Nicole Skanga covers DHS for us. Nicole, what happened?
U.S. Border Patrol Chief Raul Ortiz testified at the U.S.-Mexico border yesterday. He was asked by Chairman Mark Green whether or not the Department of Homeland Security had operational control of the border. And he said, no, sir. Now, that is a bit of a departure from what officials at DHS have said previously. Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas saying last year that the U.S. has had operational control. Keep in mind, the definition of operational control is the prevention of all unlawful entries into the United States, something that this country has not seen in decades, let alone, you know, ever. Border crossings, we should point out, however, are at a 2-year low for the second consecutive months, and we just got those numbers in this week.
And so was this the truth finally getting out, or did he misstate things?
This was indeed the truth. The border chief, you know, pushing for the United States to impose more consequences for illegal immigration, talking about the need for more prosecutions, as well as more tools to be able to deal with some of the migrant surges that we have seen in recent years. You know, those propelled by extreme poverty and economic collapse, you know, endemic violent crime throughout Central America, you know, Cuba, Haiti. But again, you know, we should point out that the U.S. Border Patrol is recording less apprehensions this month. They recorded roughly 130,000 apprehensions of migrants who crossed the southern border illegally in February. That's virtually the same level as in January. And it's a 40% drop from last December.
Is there any way of quantifying, for example, you and I both know that the Republicans are going to use the situation at the border against the Biden administration. But if you were to compare the Trump administration versus the Biden administration, are the numbers about the same, or is the Biden administration doing worse than what the Trump administration was doing at the border?
Well, unfortunately, when we talk about better or worse, it's really all in relative terms. Of course, we did see a drop in the number of apprehensions at the U.S.-Mexico border throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. But the White House now, under President Biden, has expanded its use of Title 42, which is a pandemic era relic that was first put in place by the Trump administration. It's allowed us to the U.S. government to expel migrants back into Mexico if they enter the U.S. illegally, though there are exceptions. Now, that's set to end on May 11th, and in its place, administration officials are hoping to enact a new asylum restriction that would allow the government to deport migrants more quickly if they failed to seek asylum in other countries en route to the U.S. That's, you know, that rule is now in what's called a comment period, but it has been compared to something that was proposed under the Trump administration called a transit ban. Still at the same time, the Biden administration attempting to get a hold of the situation by announcing a deal with Mexico that allows the U.S. to send up to 30,000 migrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela back across the border every month, while permitting the same number of migrants from those four countries to seek asylum in the U.S. lawfully through the expansion of humanitarian parole. The last thing, Jeff, when we look at this most recent statistics out by CBP, unlawful crossings by migrants from those four nations did fall from 84,190 in December to just over 2,000 during February. So we are seeing some inroads made by the Biden administration, despite all of this criticism from GOP lawmakers.
Nicole Skanga, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That is America Changed Forever for this week. Thanks to Paul Woody Woodhull and District Productive. You can hear us on SiriusXM POTUS Channel 124 every Saturday. For now, I'm Jeff Pagaz, and that is how America changed forever.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to America Changed Forever ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Are you ready for an all-new season of Survivor? You better be, because Survivor 46 is here, and it's 90 minutes of twists and turns you don't want to miss. Better yet, after each episode, there's a brand new episode of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. Each week, we go behind the scenes of the episode's biggest moments, taking you into the how and the why things happened. And this season, we're very lucky to be joined by an expert, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
What is up? I'm thrilled to be joining this team and to be giving you my take on how and the why players made the moves they did, what it takes to outwit, outplay, and outlast, and to ask Jeff some questions, because even after 26 days out there, there is still a lot for me to uncover.
Bring it, D. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcast.
Catch every episode of 60 Minutes, America's most watched news magazine show, as a podcast. Hear in-depth investigations across politics, news, and entertainment on your schedule. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.